المعاناه المهمه.
The port of Hodeida is one of the important ports in the Red Sea, and direct and indirect corporate losses are estimated at $1.24 billion in total. This is a large sum, since the Red Sea Ports Corporation is responsible for 70% of the imports sent to the 20 governorates for more than 20 million Yemenis.
Yemen has been suffering from a sea and air blockade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its war in March 2015, which has destroyed the country's infrastructure, killed tens of thousands of civilians, and starved millions of women and children. As the Saudi war on Yemen approaches its seventh year, Yemeni's calls for the demilitarization of Port of Hodeida continue to be ignored by the United Nations and other relevant international organizations. From Port of Hodeida, Abdul Latif Al-Washali.
Turkey has the longest continental coastline in the eastern Mediterranean and rejects the maritime boundary claims of Greece and the Greek Cypriot administration in the region. Ankara says these claims are excessive and violate the sovereign rights of both Turkey and Turkish Cypriots. The EU decided on punitive measures against Turkey last year after Ankara asserted its rights in the region by sending several drill ships to explore for energy on its continental shelf. However, the implementation of sanctions has been postponed until March, and Turkey says it is ready to get its relationship with the EU back on track in 2021.
We are inviting Greece, which has been increasing its airspace violations and unlawful activities in islands that are demilitarized, to give up their actions that are raising tensions. I believe that the exploratory talks with our neighbor Greece, which will start on the 25th of January, will, God willing, herald a new period.
European diplomats have signaled the dispute between Turkey and Greece is of paramount importance and also that progress has already been made.
What I have felt from my discussion with the minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu is progress has been made too, both in the way of relations between Turkey and Greece and in relations between Turkey and Cyprus and in relations between Turkey and France, to give you some examples.
Another issue high on the agenda for talks is Turkey's EU membership bid. Negotiations began in 2005, but have since come to a standstill. Erdogan says Turkey's membership will be a good thing for the EU, now Britain has left the bloc.
Uncertainties that are increasing with Brexit can only be dissipated with Turkey receiving its rightful place in the European family. We, as a country, are ready to put our relations back on track and create positive agendas with a long-term perspective.
In recent talks, Turkey has been quick to remind the EU of its dependence on Ankara when it comes to preventing hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants from trying to cross into European nations. Turkey says by taking initiatives in places like Syria and Libya, it is contributing to the EU's security considerably and is calling on the bloc not to allow disputes with individual members like Greece and France to jeopardize that. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In a vote which fell almost totally along party lines, Donald Trump has become the first United States president to be impeached twice. Before Bill Clinton in 1998, there was only one other impeachment ever, reflecting how highly polarized the nation has become. The impeachment appears totally symbolic. A trial in the Senate and a two-thirds vote in favor is needed to actually convict and expel Trump. The Senate will not meet until January 19th, and Joe Biden will be inaugurated as president on January 20th.
Trump will be out of the office in 7 days. I mean, you know, like, I think that I understand and I'm sympathetic to people who want him out earlier, but I just don't think that it's the a priority of anybody who wants to make sure that this doesn't continue. And the goal should be to cut across the sympathies for these right-wing actions.
Just 1 week earlier, the entire world was shocked after a protest burst into the Capitol building, the home of America's parliament, stopping the counting of the Electoral College's disputed presidential votes, anger, accusations, despair, and emotional outbursts immediately swept the nation and may not lessen even after impeachment. Some top media have compared the events, which occurred on the date 1-6, to 9-11. The Democrat-dominated House of Representatives successfully charged Trump with incitement to insurrection so quickly that many wonder if they have set a dangerous precedent of a so-called snap impeachment. Worries are widespread that the only practical result of the historic impeachment is even more division in a nation already racked by the coronavirus, racial strife, police brutality, years of tremendous cultural disunity, and economic catastrophe.
I think that impeachment is a good side dish, but it should not be the focus of anybody who considers themselves to be on the left. I understand why the center might do that, why neoliberals might do it, but Keynesian, you know, if you will, actions such as the $2,000, universal health care, that these things need to be put forth to undermine the growth of the right, the growing right, which I don't think impeachment is going to address.
The controversial decision of the House of Representatives came after the FBI warned that armed anti-inauguration protests are expected across all 50 state capitals starting on January 16th and ending on Inauguration Day at the earliest. The United States will remain in a historic state of tension and animosity until then, and maybe even long after. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Saudi atrocities against Yemeni children are endless. Hodeidah is one of the worst affected areas in Yemen. The children there suffer from life-threatening malnutrition. They are in dire need of assistance and medical treatment.
Hodeidah has a very high malnutrition burden for several reasons. The main reason is the aggression that has besieged the governorate and its coast, preventing fishermen from going to the sea and obtaining adequate food. Another reason is the rising unemployment. Here is the 3-year-old Saba struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit.
The 3-year-old Saba is struggling to survive. She has just got out of the intensive care unit. The United Nations warned weeks ago that at least 98,000 Yemeni children were suffering from malnutrition at record high rates. However, despite the ongoing collapse of the health system in Yemen, there has yet been no international response.
There has been a noticeable increase in the number of malnutrition cases in the past 2 months. They exceed the hospital's capacity, where we only have 12 beds. We had to receive patients in other departments, such as the emergency department, and this affects the health of children and increases the number of deaths.
The health sector in Yemen has suffered a continuous deterioration amid the Saudi-led war in the country. Saudi-led coalitions of blockade has prevented the arrival of food and medicine to millions of Yemeni children and women. The Saudi-led coalition is not only targeting the Yemeni children with airstrikes, but also violates their most basic rights, such as access to food and medicine, in a clear breach of the international humanitarian law. Abdul Latif Al-Washari, Al-Hudaydah.
Iran's navy has unveiled the country's largest military vessel called Makran. It is a mobile base that can carry choppers and support the military frigates of the Iranian Army's Navy. This 228-meter auxiliary ship was in fact a trade ship, but the Army changed it basically to turn into a floating port capable of carrying up to 82,000 tons of warships' needs. The support ship can also carry 5 helicopters and a battalion. It can travel for 1,000 days without having access to ports. Zereh was the other vessel unveiled by the Navy in the presence of top commanders.
The Iranian frigate called Zereh, or Armor, is an extremely useful vessel. It is very fast and powerful and can carry out its missions very well. It is equipped with advanced radars and electronic warfare facilities. Zereh can play a great role in safeguarding Iran's national interests. As the frigate is a totally indigenous one, it shows that our experts have successfully bypassed the sanctions.
Zereh is a missile-launching frigate of 47 meters length that can move at a speed of 35 nautical miles. It can launch cruise missiles up to 300 kilometers. After joining these two vessels, some sudden drills called Marine Power 99 were staged to check the readiness of the forces.
These drills were not on our agenda. The goal was to check the preparedness and quick reaction of our facilities and forces. Vessels, submarines, drones, coast-to-sea missiles were tested during this exercise, and they entered the mock danger zone extending over 600,000 kilometers.
The surface-to-surface cruise missiles, submarine, and flight units of the Iranian Navy took part in the drills.
With these two vessels joining the Iranian Navy, the country's waters are safer than before, and a clear message is sent to Iran's enemies that they should never think of waging a war against the country. Human Abedi, Konarak.
As things stand, it is very unclear how many people in the EU have so far actually received a COVID-19 vaccine, how many doses are currently being sent to each of the 27 member states, and when various groups can expect to get the jab. EU lawmakers have been discussing the issue in the European Parliament.
European Union citizens have a lot less vaccines available to them than they should have. The European Commission has planned this badly. Perhaps they were too bureaucratic.
On the 15th of October last, the European Commission set out clear guidelines to encourage each government in the EU to prepare for vaccination rollout, including the need to have sufficient numbers of trained personnel.
We invite the members to reflect on making sure that the necessary infrastructure is in place, that the necessary equipment is in place, taking into account the technical specificities of the vaccines.
Despite being given 2.5 months' notice, many EU countries did not prepare. Vaccines were left in boxes instead of being put into people's arms. We have been speaking to citizens about the vaccine rollout.
Things are not that well done at the moment. I think that we need maximum information about everything. People need to know.
It was too slow, but now we have vaccines, then we must quickly act.
Yeah, I think it's better to have done it safely, but I mean, the price to pay is that it may take a bit longer.
More people have now been vaccinated in the UK than in all of the 27 EU member states combined.
Could we have been doing more about creating better capacity building for the manufacturing of the vaccines? And could we have done more in order to adjust the expectations from the citizens about the speediness of how we roll out these vaccines?
Some lawmakers say the credibility of the EU is being undermined by the fact that some member states, such as Germany, Denmark and Cyprus, are seeking extra vaccines outside of the European Commission's vaccine strategy. With the Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna vaccines having already been approved for use in the EU, the European Medicines Agency is due to give the green light to a third, the AstraZeneca vaccine, on the 29th of this month. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil ministry has signed major investment agreements with domestic contractors in a bid to boost crude oil production. As part of the deals, the National Iranian South Oil Company and the Iranian Offshore Oil Company agreed to contract out major onshore projects in four oil-rich provinces, as well as offshore projects in the Persian Gulf, to domestic companies. The projects are worth $1.2 billion. Oil Minister Bijan Namdar Zanganeh says this is the last stage of a plan that aims to boost Iran's crude output by some 300,000 barrels a day.
We have pursued this plan since a few years ago, and today the 31st contract was signed. The agreements will ramp up the output by increasing the recovery factor of our oil fields. This is estimated to add about $1.5 billion annually to our total oil income.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. The country's oil production has almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day since U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal and reimposed unilateral oil embargoes on Iran 3 years ago. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels a day, down from 2.5 million. Zanganes says Iran plans to increase its oil production by more than twofold next year to 4.5 million barrels per day.
Due to the sanctions, the share of oil exports in our annual budget has slashed by 14%. But the restrictions have pushed us to discover new domestic capacities to keep the oil industry afloat. All of these contracts have been signed with Iranian contractors. Furthermore, over 70% of the needed equipment are manufactured indigenously. We are not going to relinquish our domestic capacities in the oil industry, even if the sanctions are lifted.
Last year, oil exports accounted for 35% of Iran's budget. Along with the U.S. sanctions, the coronavirus pandemic has also squeezed Iran's oil revenues by cutting global demand.
While Iran is poised to make a strong comeback to the oil market, officials say crude revenues will cover only 25% of the country's next year budget, despite a projected rise in exports. This is Tehran is making a strategic shift to non-oil revenues to shield the economy from the ups and downs of its petroleum sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Leaders of Russia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan set for talks in the Russian capital Moscow to discuss the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh. The negotiations lasted about 4 hours, during which Russian President Vladimir Putin called for resolving issues connected with the peacekeeping operation, as well as clarification of demarcation lines, humanitarian problems, and protection of cultural heritage sites.
Today, we can note with satisfaction that trilateral agreements are applied in practice. We believe that it creates necessary conditions for a full-fledged settlement of the old conflict on the just basis in the interests of both Azeri and Armenian nations.
Putin thanked Aliyev and Pashinyan for the fact that they positively perceived the active mediation actions of Russia aimed at stopping the bloodshed and stabilizing the situation. After 6 weeks of deadly fighting in and around Karabakh in September, Yerevan and Baku eventually agreed on November 9th to end hostilities under a Moscow broker deal that secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan in Karabakh and seven surrounding districts. The situation seems calm, with the exchange of prisoners and bodies of the dead carried out smoothly.
I believe that the key to success is to put an end to the presence of non-regional players such as France and the US. Experience shows that integration of regional players lead to great achievements. As we saw in the case of Syria, regional conflicts are resolved only when regional players sit for talks.
Following the trilateral talks in the Kremlin, the parties signed a joint statement on the development of Nagorno-Karabakh. To this end, it was decided that a plan be presented in the near future by the deputy prime ministers of Russia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia.
2 months have passed since the ceasefire was signed. Our presence here shows that we are determined to fulfill the commitments made in September and November.
Unfortunately, today we couldn't resolve the issue of war prisoners. This is the most sensitive and painful issue. We agreed to continue our cooperation in this area. We believe that the 8th paragraph of our joint statement has not yet been fully implemented. I hope we could make a concrete decision as soon as possible.
As part of the ceasefire, nearly 2,000 Russian peacekeepers have stationed along the Lachin Corridor in Azerbaijan, a 60 kilometers long route that links Hankendi to Armenia.
According to the Russian Ministry of Defense, by January 10th, over 48,000 refugees from Armenia returned to the region. The Russian department conducts round-the-clock monitoring of the situation and the ceasefire in the region. In addition, damming work continues. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
In less than 2 weeks, Democrat Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. But unlike the country's much-touted slogan of peaceful transition of power, nothing within the country seems peaceful. The capital, Washington, D.C., saw unprecedented fatal riots on the Capitol building. It all began after supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump attacked Congress during its meeting to certify Biden's win in the November election. Officials have blamed Trump for inciting the violence as he kept refusing for months to concede defeat. They say U.S. democracy is in danger. President Trump now faces threats of impeachment just days before his tenure comes to an end. House Democrats have already drafted articles of impeachment against Trump over the Wednesday insurrection. The draft was prepared after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called on Trump to resign immediately. She also urged the invocation of the 25th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The amendment calls for the removal of a president who is unable to discharge his official duties. Trump has been shunned by many members of his own Republican Party as well. President-elect Biden has also called him one of the most incompetent presidents in U.S. history. Outside the country, world leaders, including Washington's allies, have criticized Trump's supporters' attack on Capitol Hill.
What we witnessed was an assault on democracy by violent rioters incited by the current president and other politicians. Violence has no place in our societies, and extremists will not succeed in overruling the will of the people.
Britain has reacted too.
But President Trump has been saying about that has been completely wrong, and I unreservedly condemn encouraging people to behave in the disgraceful way that they did in the Capitol.
France criticized the Capitol riot, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel blamed Trump for sharing the blame. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro called the violence a reflection of what Washington has been using to do with other countries.
What we see that Donald Trump did, without a doubt, is what they're used to doing with the countries of the world. These same poor rural whites are the ones one sees dressed up as Superman, invading Iraq, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Panama, and Grenada.
The U.S. has always regarded itself as the bastion of democracy in the world. Now, the recent chaotic scenes are seen as undeniable proof of the fragility of democracy there, while they also mark an extraordinary moment in the American history.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. You're listening to us from the holy city of Qom. In this series of shows, we're trying to answer some doubts and misconceptions regarding theological issues. For these calls, we have invited the Islamic researcher and scholar Sheikh Murtada Karimi to the studio to help us to answer the questions. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. If you remember in our previous session, we have started a discussion but it was left incomplete, and inshallah today we will be trying to continue that discussion again today, and it was concerning the reappearance of the aged Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. It was said that based on the narrations, Imam will emerge while oppression and tyranny is prevalent and has filled the world. So what is the reason that Imam is not coming, does not reappear, while the tyranny and oppression actually is suffocating the people of the earth? What more tyranny and oppression is needed for his arrival to come? If Allah is going to spread his lots, his kindness over the human being, so what else is needed for the arrival of the last Savior? We have answered this question to some extent in our previous session, and we referred to some even more wretched and worst cases like the Second World War and other events in the history, and we reached this conclusion that it might not be the time for his reappearance. Is it true, Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, that was the first point, the fact that the amount of oppression which we see today is not unprecedented. We have had other cases in the history. And according to the narrations, the amount of oppression does not matter. What matters is the fact that the world is full of oppression to the extent that almost all the people feel the need for the savior. But that was the first point. Now, the second point is that we should not think that, Imam is the Imam as long as he is the ruler on the people, and if he is not ruling, he is not the Imam. This is not the case. Imam has two functions, according to Shia understanding of imamate. We know that in the history of the Shia, only Imam Ali alayhi salam was the ruler of the time for about five years, and Imam Hassan alayhi salam for a few months. But the other Imams, they did not rule over the Islamic community and Islamic nation. So the fact that the Imams were not ruler does not mean that they were not the Imams. No, Imam is an Imam in guiding the people, in helping the people. Imam is an intermediary between the people, between the creatures and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So although Imam Mahdi alayhi salam apparently is not among us, but he is the Imam. He is guiding the Ummah in one way or another, as mentioned in the narrations, like the sun behind the clouds. The next point is the fact that some people suppose that the Imam, when he reappears, he will finish the oppression and he will remove the enemies and the oppressors in a miraculous way. Like Prophet Musa alayhi salam, he performed a miracle by his staff. The river was divided into two parts. He and his followers, they passed, and then the Pharaoh and his soldiers, they were drowned in the sea. This is not the case for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. We should not think that when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam reappears, all the rulers of the world, all these oppressive regimes, and all these people who are, the followers of capitalism in the world, they will come and surrender to the will of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam peacefully. Yes, many people, lay people, common people, when they see the Imam, yeah, and they see some of the signs, the divine signs in the Imam, they will follow him. Mm-hmm. But the main, causes of the oppression of the world, they are there, and they will fight Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. All these followers of different schools that we have nowadays in the world, liberalism, capitalism, and so on and so forth. So we should not think that all of them will come to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and surrender and just say that, okay, we are not following our school of thought, we are not going to oppress the people anymore. No, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam needs to fight a group of people, at least, who are the main causes of the oppression. Now the point is that for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to lead such a kind of uprising against these oppressive, he is in need of a considerable number of the people. So he is not going to fight the enemies in a miraculous way. This is our understanding from the narrations. So many people they say that according to the narrations, the followers of those people who helped Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, they are 313 people. So some people, you hear the people many times, they say that Imam Mehdi al-Salam, he does not have this number of the people. They are very few in number, 313. But the point is that can we imagine that Imam Mehdi al-Salam will fight all these superpowers in the world only with 313 people?
Yeah.
It's not possible, not at all. These people are the closest circle around Imam Mehdi alayhi salam. They are maybe the commanders of the armies. So in the second circle, Imam Mehdi alayhi salam, let's say for example, needs 10,000 people. In the third circle, he needs hundreds of thousands of people. Yes. So this confirms the idea that as the followers of Imam Mehdi alayhi salam, we also should prepare ourselves. So even if the world is full of oppression, which is not the case, but Imam Mehdi alayhi salam needs a considerable number of the people to help him in this uprising against oppression. 313 are just the first circle.
How come that 313 are going to actually face the whole world in order to be victorious?
This is my point exactly. 313 people are the first circle around Imam Mehdi alayhi salam. Maybe they are the commanders of the army. In the second circle, Imam Mehdi needs tens of thousands of the people.
And then
hundreds of thousands of the people.
Can't Imam make the people accompany him with his logic that he brings to the whole world? That actually the kind of target that he introduces to the people, won't it help Imam to make people accompany him?
According to some narrations, because there is a discussion whether after the reappearance of Imam Mahdi, other religions will remain in the world or not. There is a kind of differences of idea among the people. Some people, some scholars yes, some scholars say no. But at the end of the day, some people will accept the Imam, but the number of the people who resist and fight Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is also considerable, and they are the superpowers. They have all these military facilities and equipment, which means that the army of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam must be also physically speaking and military speaking, they need to be powerful as well. So Imam also needs a considerable number of the people. This is my point. Of course, the divine help is there. We are not negating the divine help, but it doesn't mean that Imam will do a miracle to fight and defeat the enemy. There is a narration which confirms this idea that without a good number of the people, Imam will not reappear. In one narration, we have a person, a companion of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. One of his companions told Imam that why you are not uprising against the oppressive rulers, the Abbasids. The same question was asked by other companions of the Imams in other occasions. And the Imam mentioned that we know the best opportunity, and right now we do not have enough number of the people who are really our followers. We have in one narration that one companion of the Imam asked the Imam that why you are not uprising, and Imam asked him to go and throw himself in the oven.
Yeah.
And he said that I'm not going to do that. The man, I think, was from Khorasan. And then another companion of the Imam came, and he did so, and nothing happened to him, nothing harmed him. And then the Imam asked that man from Khorasan that how many people are like this companion of mine, that they really believe in me. And the man was convinced that this is not the time. So we should not think only about the oppression. Also, we should think about whether we have, enough people to help Imam Mahdi alayhi salam after his reappearance or not.
Okay, Sheikh, then one short question, and inshallah we shall finalize the discussion. If we are expecting those few people to be among only Muslims and then specifically among Shias, Do you think that Iman will be able to, for example, to overcome the whole world with this few number of people? Or no, his logic will persuade people to join him from different religions, different, let's say, followers of Abrahamic religions.
Mm-hmm. The conclusion of my discussion is both. I mean, first of all, from those people who believe in him, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam needs a considerable number of the people to initiate the uprising, and then after initiating the uprising, the people from other schools and other religion might also help. But at the end of the day, Imam needs a considerable number of the people to initiate the uprising and then to be supported by other people as well.
Thank you very much. And those 313 are only Shias?
Yes.
Or?
Okay. According to Narushin, they are the Shias.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada, for your scholarly answers to the questions and your respected listeners for staying tuned with us and listening to Q&A and Islamic Beliefs. I would like to invite you to our next session to join us then. Till then, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. A climate model released by the prestigious scientific publisher Springer Nature offers a roadmap for meeting and surpassing the target set by the Paris Climate Agreement, showing that we can solve the global climate crisis with currently available technologies and natural climate solutions. The book, titled Achieving the Paris Climate Agreement, was the culmination of a two-year collaboration with 17 leading scientists at the University of Technology, Sydney, two institutes at the German Aerospace Centre, DLR, and the University of Melbourne's Climate and Energy College. Stay with us for an article penned by the staff writers of OneEarth.com website, published under the heading Below 1.5 degrees Celsius, a breakthrough roadmap to solve the climate crisis. Stay with us. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, warned in its special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius released October 2018, to Earth must be kept below the dangerous threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius in global average temperature rise, above pre-industrial levels, if we are to avoid a worsening of climate-related impacts. We are already seeing the devastating consequences of the current 1 degree C global temperature increase, including rising sea levels in many coastal cities, extreme storms, prolonged droughts, and intensified wildfires. The impacts resulting from higher temperatures are almost unimaginable. The death of the coral reefs in every ocean, the collapse of nearly one quarter of the world's agricultural land, dramatically increased heat waves and wildfires, 100 million people driven to extreme poverty, sparking multiple refugee crises, 1 meter of sea level rise in some regions, and more than $11 trillion per year in damages from extreme storm and flooding. Stacked upon each other, these impacts and many more could undermine the very fabric of life on our planet, greatly challenging the continuation of human civilization as we currently know it. Up until now, it was assumed to be difficult, if not impossible, to achieve the carbon budget required to stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius rise, a maximum of 400 billion tons of cumulative carbon dioxide emissions, from January 2018 onwards. Humans today release approximately 39 cumulative carbon dioxide emissions per year, mostly from burning of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. At other current level of emissions, we would only have 7 years to completely cease the use of all fossil fuels, which is clearly not feasible. While many scientists have modeled 1.5 degrees Celsius climate mitigation pathways to make the math work, almost all of them require the use of unproven and potentially dangerous geoengineering strategies like solar radiation management or bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. The 1.5 degrees Celsius climate model is groundbreaking in that it shows the 1.5 degrees Celsius target can be achieved through a rapid transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050, 56% by 2030, alongside a major conservation effort to increase the resilience of natural ecosystems and help ensure greater food security. This includes a moratorium on land conversions by 2030 and 400 cumulative carbon dioxide emissions of negative emissions from forest and land restoration, which pulls carbon dioxide out of atmosphere and stores it in trees and soil. Co-author and editor, Dr. Sven Teske, a research director of the Institute for Sustainable Futures at the University of Technology at Sydney, Australia, said, "Scientists cannot fully predict the future, but advanced modeling allows us to map the best scenarios for creating a global energy system fit for the 21st century. And with momentum around the Paris Climate Agreement lagging, it's crucial that decision makers around the world can see that we can, in fact, meet global energy demand at a lower cost with clean, renewable energy. Some have doubted that a transition to 100% renewable energy is even possible. To explore the potential, the scientists created a sophisticated computer model of the world's electrical grids to date, with 10 regional and 72 sub-regional energy grids modeled in hourly increments to the year 2050. Along with a comprehensive assessment of available renewable resources like wind and solar energy, minerals required for manufacturing of components, and configurations for meeting projected energy demand and storage most efficiently for all sectors over the next 30 years. The result of the modeling effort shows that not only is it possible to switch to 100% renewable energy for all energy users, but it will cost much less to operate than today's energy system. Moreover, it will eliminate the toxic pollution associated with the burning of fossil fuels, estimated to be a primary cause of 9 million premature deaths per year. The renewable energy transition will not only improve public health worldwide, it will also drive economic development, providing the 30 million people currently working in the energy sector with permanent, well-paying jobs and creating an additional 12 million new jobs. The proposed energy transition outlined in the 1.5 degrees Celsius climate model will require investment globally of approximately $1.7 trillion per year. This sounds like a lot of money, but it pales in comparison to the vast subsidies governments currently provide to prop up the ailing fossil fuel industry, estimated at more than $4.7 trillion per year by the International Monetary Fund, IMF. Taxpayers are unwittingly funding the climate crisis, and that needs to stop. The research tells us that we could be creating the clean energy future we so desperately need for the less than one-third of what we're spending now, and in so doing, improve energy access in the developing world. There are five major components to the renewable energy transition. First is increased capacity to generate electricity, mostly through solar and wind power, enabling the electrification of all energy users, including power, heating, transportation, and even industrial users. Second is increased storage capacity in the form of battery arrays and pumped hydroelectric, which uses excess generation of pumped water up to a reservoir, releasing the energy when needed. Third is energy efficiency, decreasing overall energy consumption, especially in the developed world, by making buildings, cities, and vehicles more efficient. Fourth involves repurposing the existing gas pipeline and storage infrastructure to deliver hydrogen produced by renewable sources. A fifth is a gradual retraining of the energy workforce to participate in the burgeoning green economy. The sixth major component of the climate model is land restoration. Malte Mainshausen, co-author, founding director of the Climate and Energy College at the University of Melbourne in Australia, says, citing a growing body of research, we show that using land restoration efforts to meet negative emission requirements, along with the transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050, gives the world a good chance of staying below the 1.5 degrees Celsius target. Natural climate solutions, including everything from restoring natural forests, grasslands, and wetlands, to improving soil fertility through regenerative agricultural practices like agroforestry, silvopasture, and cover crops. These solutions not only absorb carbon, they also dramatically increase sustainable livelihoods in the developing world, offering improved water supplies, reduced soil erosion, and higher quality of crop yields. The 1.5 degrees Celsius model shows just how important our natural ecosystems are. Carl Burkhardt, managing director of One Earth, says, nature is the missing key. While the renewable energy transition is imperative to solving the climate crisis, it isn't enough. Currently, wildlands and oceans absorb one-half of all our carbon dioxide emissions. As this climate model shows, in order to keep global temperature rise to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, we have to keep our natural carbon sinks intact, scale up restoration efforts, and shift to regenerative agriculture. Without them, we have no future. The land use sector should be a big part of the climate solution. Unfortunately, because of rampant deforestation and unsustainable industrial agriculture and livestock practices, it is a net emitter of greenhouse gas pollution. Many efforts like the New York Declaration on Forests is working to halt deforestation by 2030, and United Nations Sustainable Development Goals 15 calls ending up to this destructive practice. The climate model shows that by protecting natural ecosystems and completely phasing out deforestation in the 2030s, we can maintain the integrity of the carbon sinks, and those sinks that are so vital to rebalancing our global climate system. The newly released climate model is part of the larger One Earth initiative, which builds upon the latest science to create a vision for a world that is possible in 2050. A world in which humanity and nature can coexist and thrive together. The vision is based upon three pillars of action: 100% renewable energy, the protection and restoration of 50% of the world's lands and oceans, and a transition to regenerative agriculture. Together, these pillars of action give us a global roadmap to tackle the climate crisis and to ensure a sustainable future for all of Earth's inhabitants. After 20 years of negotiations, the world governments came together under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, and established the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. They created a structure in which countries could submit pledges called Nationally Determined Commitments, or NDCs, that would be added together to achieve the target of staying well below 2 degrees Celsius in global average temperature rise, with a goal of gradually increasing commitments over time. While the Paris Climate Accord was a success in many ways, it's very clear that it will not deliver what is needed to achieve reductions sufficient to avoid a climate crisis. The latest analysis of government commitments by Climate Action Tracker estimates the current pledges would result in about 2.85 degrees Celsius of global temperature rise. There is hope, however, in the next commitment period that pledges will increase as the world wakes up to the disastrous impact of our current level of global warming. It's clear that all three pillars of action are required to achieve the goal of limiting warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. A transition to 100% renewable energy by 2050, whilst incredibly aggressive, is not sufficient to get to a lower 50% likelihood of the target, much less a strong 67% likelihood. Environmental conservation, which avoids approximately 100 GT CO2 emissions from land use, change relative to the reference case, plus 275 GT CO2 in negative emissions from environmental restoration, gets us very close to that goal. But it takes an additional 25 GT CO2 in negative emissions from the agricultural sector to actually get to a strong likelihood of staying below 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in average temperatures.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, why do some parents discriminate? Brothers and sisters, we have seen parents discriminate between their children due to several different reasons. It is un-Islamic to do so. When Allah has gifted us with our children, we are supposed to have justice. We are supposed to carry out justice amongst them. Now, studies have discovered that discrimination may cause severe mental and physical health disturbances. It is not uncommon for such children at receiving end to show signs of anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorders, and personality disorders. It can also make them prone to illness like high blood pressure, high disease, and diabetes later in life. So now these are medical consequences of you discriminating between your children, you giving more attention to one and ignoring other child. Discrimination can cause severe and permanent damage to a child's psyche. Children who are subjected to prejudice, ridicule, and emotional trauma develop negative coping strategies. They are at an increased risk for developing issues with aggression, depression, anxiety, issues with self-esteem, and in forming and sustaining relationships. So, if you discriminate, God forbid, for whatever reason, right, what is more likely to happen is that the child who is at the receiving end of this discrimination, he or she is going to end up to create imbalance in the society. They're going to ruin the balance of the society. Hence, we have to be very careful of our actions. Pay equal attention to all of your children. Welcome back to your listeners. We are discussing today, why do some parents discriminate? And this is something we all need to understand and learn. Discrimination may be harmful for children in a number of ways. Number one, children who are taught to suppress their emotions at home have a greater chance of being bullied at school. Number two, these children can feel inferior with a peer group setting and can develop issues with social interaction and being accepted as part of the group. This can lead to a child feeling lonely and isolated. Number three, all types of discrimination can lower self-belief and self-worth of a child. It can make the child feel powerless and helpless. It can resist and restrict a child from reaching their full potential. Number four, all forms of discrimination at home, school, or in workplace are extremely harmful for a person's mental health. It is especially damaging to a person if it happens to them during their childhood. A child's psyche may not be developed enough to cope with insults, emotional pain, or trauma, which are synonymous with discrimination. So these are some of the very few of the ways a child can get negatively impacted and affected. Okay? So when you're treating your child, and especially if you have been blessed with multiple children, make sure that you are not discriminating between your children. Make sure that you're giving them confidence. You're growing them spiritually, mentally, academically. Okay? So discrimination is something un-Islamic to do. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com.